This is Christine Downing, 5 December 1997.
Jungian Society, December 5th, Christine Downing. The title is All Real Living is Meeting.
Pleasure to introduce Dr. Christine Downing tonight. I feel like I first got introduced to her through one of her books, The Long Journey Home, on the myth of Demeter and Persephone. And it was a real inspiration to me to do some of my own writing on that myth, so I really appreciated that. And then last year, had a chance to hear her speak at Pacifica, where she's currently on the faculty in the Mythological Studies program, but also lectures in the Clinical Psychology program. And it was in that program that I heard her speak about Martin Buber. Dr. Downing was chair of the Religious Studies program at San Diego State University for 20 years, and but retired from that position. She now lives in this area and enjoys the Pacific Northwest with the rest of us. So I won't take any more time, but introduce her. Welcome her, please.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back here. I'm very well aware. Is this sound all right for you? Because it's very strange for me.
A little echoey.
What?
A little echoey.
Let's see how. Is that better?
Yeah.
It seems. It was just feeling strange to me, too. I wanted to begin just by acknowledging that I'm well aware that my lecture this evening is part of a series that the Jung Society here has put together on Jung and religion. And yet I want to say that I don't this evening plan to talk very much about Jung, but rather will be talking about my sense that what Jung has to teach us about religion needs to be complemented by what I've learned from Martin Buber. I also want to say here at the outset that I don't plan this evening to talk very much about how both Jung and Buber fail to appreciate what I take to be the complementarity of their perspectives. And indeed, the degree to which they actually understood their perspectives as opposed is something that saddens me. I'm willing to address my understanding of their mutual misunderstanding and sense of betrayal in the question period, but I really don't want that to be what I'm here to focus on this evening. Because what I want to focus on is Buber's sense that the most important word to communicate our relation to the transcendent is not self, but you. And that, in a way, is really a summary of what it is that I'd like to communicate this evening. Because unlike Jung, Buber sees religion and psychology as vastly different. Indeed, he really wants passionately to help us see the same gulf that he sees between religion and psychology, between what he calls aiming at the self on the one hand, and on the other, turning toward the other. Now, maybe a way of beginning to communicate what I most want to about Buber is to invite you to reflect for a few moments on the vast differences between the autobiographies that each of them composed when he was in his late 80s. Buber's autobiography was called Meetings. Jung's, as I'm sure you all know, was called Memories, Dreams, Reflections. I think it's interesting to take a moment to consider what, in retrospect, as men in their 80s, these two saw as constituting the most significant moments in their lives. For Jung, I think it's clearly dreams. At least as I look back at my own reading of Memories, Dreams, Reflections, what always stand out for me are three particular periods in Jung's life where dreams and other imaginal experiences really were dominant. The account that he gives us in his autobiography of his childhood, the very extensive account that he calls Encounter with the Unconscious, that six-year deep immersion in his own inner world that he entered upon almost immediately after his break with Freud. And then again, the dreams that came upon him shortly after his first serious heart attack, the dreams in which he was really forced to confront his own oncoming death and his relationship to death. And Jung makes it very clear in the prologue to Memories, Dreams, Reflections that looking back at his life as an 80-year-old, he acknowledges that he might have told this story, his life story, in a different way if he'd chosen to do it in his 50s or his 60s or whatever. But that as an 80-year-old, what really stood out were those moments in his life where he touches what he calls the archetypal, the universal. And I think it's striking as we think of this particular way of telling a life, how few other persons enter into the story. Even his parents, whom he refers to, really, I think, appear very little as persons in their own right rather than as persons as they live in Jung's own psyche and Jung's own consciousness. Freud, of course, does appear. But we hear very little about his wife, nothing about Tony, nothing about other colleagues. That isn't what matters to him anymore. On the other hand, Buber, who never wrote quite as formal an autobiography as Jung did, was very close to the end of his life, invited to contribute to a series called The Library of Living Philosophers. And the books in this series were organized in a particular way. Each of the person, there were volumes dedicated to many of the most important philosophers of the 20th century. Wittgenstein, Tillich, Russell, can't think of the others right now, but you know, just about anyone that you could think of. And what happens in each instance is that the person of whom the volume was going to be about was asked to write a biography, an autobiography at the beginning, an account of his own understanding of his work. And then many, many other prominent people who were engaged in the same field were asked to contribute essays about that person's work. And then at the end, the person that the book was about was given an opportunity to respond to all the other critiques and essays that had been written. And if you look at any of the other volumes in the series, what people include in their autobiographies for this particular kind of a context is an account of who they studied with and what books they read and what thinkers have been important to them, both in the past and in present discussions and so on. But Buber did something very different. He gave us just a series of mostly short anecdotes, each of which accounts for a meeting that Buber had, that in retrospect he sees as having been truly transformative in his life. Most of these meetings are with actual human others, with family members, with friends and strangers, with whom he had a literally present kind of engagement. But he also includes persons who were present to him only through their creations, Nietzsche and Kant and Bach. And also among these meetings, he includes accounts of meetings with some non-human others, with a tree, with a cat, with a horse. And he gives us a sense that what he's trying to communicate to us is that the best way that he knows how to communicate who he is and what his life has been is to give us a record of such meetings, to give us a sense of how important it in his life, and he imagines in ours as well, our meetings where we felt ourselves in the presence of the sacred, the transformative, meetings with another whose simple being there towards us has enabled us to be fully present with them. Meetings which have seemed to include, he says, not just himself and the other, but a third presence, a presence that he calls the spirit or the between, a third presence which makes possible a kind of full presentness that usually eludes us. Now, I was very aware when I first read this little book of Buber's Meetings that for me, Martin Buber has himself been one of those by whom I've been met in this kind of way, even though I never met him personally, only through his books and, just to complicate things, in my dreams. And I want to share those dreams with you. But before that, I want to read you an account by Buber of a series of his own dreams. This is a series of dreams with which he opens the first essay in his 1929 book, Between Man and Man, an essay that he calls Zwiesprache, or dialogue, an account that he says he's giving us as a deliberate kind of attempt to fill out in a more personal way things that he had said several years earlier in his most famous book, I and Thou. So now let me read this series of dreams to you. He calls it original remembrance. Through all sorts of changes, the same dream, sometimes after an interval of several years, recurs to me. I name it the dream of the double cry. Its content is always much the same, a primitive world meagerly equipped. I find myself in a vast cave or in a mud building that reminds me when I awake of the villages of the Fellaheen or on the fringes of a gigantic forest whose like I cannot remember ever having seen. The dream begins in very different ways, but always with something extraordinary happening to me. For instance, with a small animal resembling a lion cub, whose name I know in the dream, but not when I awake, tearing the flesh from my arm and being forced only with an effort to loose its hold. The strange thing is that this first part of the dream story, which in the duration as well as the outer meaning of the incidents is easily the most important, always unrolls at a furious pace as though it didn't matter. Then suddenly, the pace abates. I stand there and cry out. In the view of the events which my waking consciousness has, I should have to suppose that this cry I utter varies in accordance with what preceded it, and is sometimes joyous, sometimes fearful, sometimes even filled with both pain and triumph. But in my morning recollection, it is neither so expressive nor so various. Each time it is the same cry, inarticulate but in strict rhythm, rising and falling, swelling to a fullness which my throat could not endure were I awake, long and slow, quiet, quite slow, and very long, a cry that is a song. When it ends, my heart stops beating, but then somewhere far away, another cry moves toward me. Another, which is the same cry uttered or sung by another voice. Yet it is not the same cry, certainly no echo of my cry, but rather its true rejoinder, its true response, tone for tone, not repeating mine, not even in a weakened form, but corresponding to mine, answering its tones, so much so that mine, which at first had had to my own ear no sound of questioning at all, now appears as questions, as a long series of questions, which now all receive a response. The response is no more capable of interpretation than the question. And yet the cries that meet the one cry that is the same do not seem to be the same as one another. Each time, the voice is new. But now, as the reply ends, in the first moment after its dying fall, a certitude, true dream certitude, comes to me. That now it has happened. Nothing more, just this, and in this way, now it has happened. If I should try to explain it, it means that that happening which gave rise to my cry has only now, with the response, really and undoubtedly happened. After this manner, the dream has recurred each time, till once, the last time, now 2 years ago. At first, it was as usual. It was the dream with the animal. My cry died away. Again, my heart stood still. I listened. I heard no sound. For I awaited the response for the first time. Before this, it had always surprised me, as though I had never heard it before. Awaited, it failed to come. But now something happened with me, as though I had until now had no other access from the world to sensations save that of the ear, and now discovered myself simply equipped with senses, both those clothed in the bodily organs and the naked senses. So I exposed myself to the distance, open to all sensation and perception, and then, not from a distance, but from the air round about me, noiselessly came the answer. Really, it didn't come. It was there. It had been there. So I may explain it, even before my cry. There it was, and now when I laid myself open to it, it let itself be received by me. I received it as completely into my perception as ever I received the response in one of the earlier dreams. If I were to report with what I heard it, I should have to say with every pore of my body. As ever, the rejoinder came in one of the earlier dreams this corresponded to and answered my cry. It exceeded the earlier response in an unknown perfection which is hard to define, for it resides in the fact that it was already there. When I'd reached an end of receiving it, I felt again that certainty, peeling out more than ever, that now it has happened. Buber's dream. And alongside this dream of Buber's, I'd like to lay two of my own. The first is a dream that I dreamt when I was in my mid-20s, almost 40 years ago. I was expecting my fourth child. I had shortly before this discovered Jung in a local library, and started reading Jung and persuaded my closest woman friend to read Jung along with me. And we had just started keeping track of our dreams and spending one evening a week sharing them with one another. It was a time in my life when I had been very involved with my roles of being wife and mother, and felt very fulfilled in those roles. I loved being a young wife and a mother. But as I had started reading Jung, I'd become aware of the many parts of me that living those roles had left untouched, had left lying dormant, waiting to be awakened. And the discovery of Jung and the beginning to pay attention to my dreams and having a friend to do that with was an enormous gift. And this dream that I'm going to tell you was one of the very first dreams that I had when I started, really for the first time in my life, consciously paying attention to my dreams. In this dream, I found myself bicycling through a woods, like those conjured up when my mother read to me from the household tales collected by the Brothers Grimm. A woods like the woods in the tale of Hansel and Gretel, or the tale of Little Red Riding Hood. And because the path that I had to take was an unfamiliar one, I held in my right hand, which of course also had to hold onto the handlebar, a hand-drawn map. The path was a narrow dirt one. It's actually very much like, I'm just realizing now, the path that I walk every morning now around Lake Cascade on Orcas, where I live. It was a very narrow dirt one with deeply marked ruts and barely concealed rocks, frequently crisscrossed by protruding roots. And there were many forks. And then once, as I took my eyes off the road to check the map, the bicycle hit one of those especially large roots. I lost my balance and I fell off the bike. The map flew out of my hand and back behind me. And after I picked myself up and dusted myself off and straightened my bicycle, I knew that I had to go back and get that map before I could proceed along my way. So I turned around and began on foot to retrace my path, looking along both the road and its periphery. I walked back quite a way without success and then saw, just a little further on, a figure sitting across the path with his back against a tree and with his legs sort of stretched out, holding something in his hand, who seemed to be beckoning me to approach. As I came nearer, I saw he was a white-bearded, wizened old man with deep-set, brilliant blue eyes and a friendly countenance. But what he wordlessly put in my hand when I reached him was not my map, but a living clump of grass. The dream ended there. Its impact did not. I felt the dream had showed me how much until then I had relied on maps, on plans, on pre-drawn schemas to guide me through my life. And after the dream, I began to trust to a more spontaneous, more organic, more growing from within kind of guidance. Though it may sound romantic, I felt the dream had changed my life. Among other things, it prepared me to welcome my first unplanned pregnancy, to welcome that pregnancy as a gift. And somehow it didn't seem surprising at all that the child who was born should be my first daughter. A few years later, a friend and I were talking about Jung and my sense of how much I'd learned from him, but how much I now needed a new teacher, one who would understand better than Jung seemed to, how the sacred comes to us sometimes in our deepest moments of connection with one another, and not only in our moments of engagement with our own deepest selves. This friend said, "Chris, you ought to read Martin Buber." And I said, "No way." Because others earlier, beginning when I was an undergraduate, had urged I and Thou on me. I'd respected their sense of what might speak to me, because they knew me well and had read the first few pages and then each time put the book aside and said, "No, Buber is not for me." But this friend insisted, and he put in my hands his own well-worn copy of Between Man and Man. So I took it, and I turned the book over, and there on the back was a photograph of Martin Buber. But rather, what I really should say was, there on the back cover was the face of the wise old man of my dream. I took the book. I read it. I ended up writing my dissertation on Martin Buber. Some 10 years after I'd finished that dissertation, by then at least 20 since I'd had the dream, during my first spring in California, which is now more than 20 years ago, I had another dream. This time I was in the desert, not in the woods. I'd come there because I knew that I was lost, that I was dispirited, depressed, directionless. I'd started out at twilight from the city and driven far into the night along increasingly unfamiliar and narrow roads. Then one of my tires went flat and I discovered I had no spare. In the distance, I saw a flickering light and I thought that it might come from a house to which I could go and telephone for help. So I started walking in the direction of the light and realized after I'd been walking for a while that the light didn't seem to be any closer than it had begun, than it had been when I first set out. And I wasn't really sure it was a light from a house at all. And I recognized that what I ought really to do was what I should have done from the very beginning, was to just go back to my car and wait, and eventually someone would come. So I turned around to do that, but of course this was a dream. And when I did that, there was no car. In fact, even the road had disappeared. And now I really was lost, and I had no idea what to do next. And then suddenly, from behind a large sage bush, there appeared a bent and wrinkled, kindly looking old man. This time I recognized him. It was Martin Buber again. "Can I help you?" he asked. "No," I replied. "No. You and I have been through this before. It is time now for me to go in search of her." And thus began the involvement with Greek goddesses, with feminist theology, with the psychology of women that has occupied me for the last 20 years or so. But I find it intriguing that Buber reappeared as a guide at that moment. In the dream, once he addressed me, I seemed to know exactly how to proceed. I made my way directly through the still unfamiliar, still untracked desert to a cave deep under the earth where she awaited me. I hadn't thought about it in quite that way until a few years ago when I was invited to participate in a conference on Buber and the humanities. I'd really, until that moment, had thought of my turning to the goddesses as a turning away from earlier perspectives. But under the impetus of putting it together, a paper for this conference, I began to recognize how much continuity there has been. a kind of continuity represented by the living clump of grass, rather than by any map I could have drawn beforehand. And as I reflect now on what led me to put myself under Buber's tutelage during the many years it takes to write a dissertation, I see how much it was because of his articulation of perspectives which seemed more congruent with my own than was true of any of the other theologians whose work I studied while I was in graduate school. Because what I found Buber saying from the first time that I really read Between Man and Man, I found Buber saying things I knew but hadn't quite known I knew, hadn't had words for. I felt that he offered me a way to be followed because it lay along my own beginning way. I didn't think then in terms of feminist perspectives or women's ways of looking at things. I think I responded to Between Man and Man as I had not been able to respond to I and Thou, because in Between Man and Man, Buber communicates so directly that he's speaking on the basis of concrete personal experiences which require him to speak, as he does also in that little book, Meetings, that I spoke of. I felt Buber opening me to aspects of my own experience, which until then I'd ignored. I felt in reading Buber that I was meant as he spoke, that he intended me, not as sometimes happens when I read Jung, that I was listening in on a monologue by someone, some of whose experiences remarkably parallel my own. Nor, as happens when I read some philosophers whose works have deeply impressed me, that I was meant because everyone is meant. In reading Buber, I felt addressed in all my particularity, understood in part, but more importantly, challenged. In fact, I'd say called. And so then, having been introduced to Buber in this way by reading Between Man and Man, I could then go back and read I and Thou and respond to its more lyrical, poetical style in a very different way. What I could do, having begun with this more personal account in Between Man and Man, was to read I and Thou and hear in it the ish and the do of the German. I could hear now the sounding of the familiar do, the German you, the you by which I was born in Germany and lived in Germany until I was four, the do by which I had been addressed as a child, and not the formal archaic thou of the translation, which had left me unmoved when I first read I and Thou. I'm struck when I think of this, as I'm also struck very often when I think of how badly served Freud has been by his translators, of how radically translation can be betrayal. One of the things when I teach Freud, I always begin by trying to get my students to feel how differently we would read Freud if we knew that every time the translation says that Freud is speaking of mind or mental structure or mental organization, what Freud had used was the German word Seele, the German word soul. And how immediately, I think, just making that simple substitution changes what we're able to hear Freud saying to us. As in a similar way, when we realize that Freud absolutely never used in German the word ego, he used the everyday German word for I, ich. And when we, you know, when we get rid of those neologisms and reading Freud, get rid of ego and id and hear ish and s and so on, it's a different Freud immediately. And I think in the same way, I had such a sense of reading Buber in a different way when I heard, when I really realized that he had used this simple do that's the word of the most intimate kind of engagement in German. The words that parents speak to child, to children, and lovers speak to one another. And I became so aware of the real difficulty there is in rendering these central insights in another language. Buber in Meeting speaks of a game that he played with himself as a child. He was an only child who was mostly raised by his grandparents, and really a very lonely child. And like a lot of only introverted kind of children, he created all kinds of games that he played with himself. And one of them was, he was a child who grew up in Austria. His parents had, his grandparents lived on a big estate in Galicia. So he knew German and Polish and Yiddish and French and Latin and one other language. I can't remember which. But anyway, one of the games that he would play with himself as a child was to have a conversation with himself, with one taking on two roles, and one of them would speak in German and one would speak in French, or one would speak in Yiddish and, you know, one would speak in Latin or whatever. And the point of this game was the way in which they could never really quite understand each other, because you just really can't say quite the same thing, you know, in one language that you can say in another. And I think Buber came later to have such a sense of the way in which that's true, even when we all talk with one another using ostensibly the same language. There's a way in which we don't ever use quite the same language after all. But anyway, I had such a sense of the way in which the you of I and thou is this familiar do that was so much part of my own childhood. And yet I think it's also important to say that this German do is something different from our everyday you. It is the most intimate form of address imaginable. And precisely because of this, there is something sacred about it. And I think it's for that this reason that Ronald Gregor Smith initially thought it was most appropriate to translate it as thou rather than as you. I think it may be very hard for us Americans to get a real sense of the specialness of the German du, which was much more special for my parents' generation than it is for Germans of my generation, and much more special than it is for Germans born since the Second World War. But in Buber's generation, it was even more special than my parents' generation. It takes years before friends agree to say do to one another. I'm going to be speaking a little later on about Buber's close collaboration with another important contemporary Jewish thinker, Franz Rosenzweig, and how after they had been working together in very difficult circumstances, week after week, for years, on their translation of the Hebrew Bible into German. It was only after many, many years of that engagement that one or the other of them said, we should say do to one another now. And there's an encounter that's included in that meetings book about an encounter that Buber had with an old man whose depths and integrity he had great respect for, who asked him after he'd heard Buber give a lecture, how can you still use the word God? What word of human speech is so misused so defiled, so desecrated. All the innocent blood that has been shed for it has robbed this word of its radiance. And Buber answered, "Yes, indeed, it is the most heavy laden of all human words. None has become so soiled, so mutilated. Just for this reason, I may not abandon it. Generations of men have laid the burden of their anxious lives upon this word and weighed it to the ground. It lies in the dust and bears their whole burden. We cannot cleanse the word God, and we cannot make it whole. But defiled and mutilated as it is, we can raise it from the ground and set it over an hour of great care." And Buber says that when he stopped speaking, the old man came over and he put his hand on Buber's shoulder and he said, "Let us say do to one another." And it wasn't that he'd been persuaded, but it was that they had really talked to one another. So I guess what I'm trying to do here is to try to communicate somehow that this word, which mostly in translations of Buber is translated as thou, this German du, has in it a sense of the sacredness of real intimacy. I guess what I'm trying to do is to communicate to you some of the inner meaning of a formality that's, you know, involved in taking years of a friendship before you move to the point where you're comfortable saying do to one another. That to us, this may seem like a kind of anachronistic formality. We're so ready with our intimacies. We move so quickly to first names and so on. But there's something in this culture that recognizes, I think, the sacredness of the intimacy. So after reading Between Man and Man, I heard that thou very differently from the way I originally heard it. And I also began to hear Buber's ish, differently. I began to hear in his eye the voice that had come from a failed encounter with a young man who came to see Buber on the eve of World War I. This is a very important moment for Buber. In Between Man and Man, he speaks of it as a conversion. In Meeting, he's changed the name. He actually cuts the same account that's in Between Man and Man is included in Meetings, but now with a different title. It's now called A Conversation. This event was one that, at just the beginning of the First World War, when Buber was still very much a mystic who spent a good part of his morning hours in meditation in one of the upper rooms of his house. And when he came down on this particular morning, he found a young man waiting in his study. And the two of them spent an hour or so together, talking. Buber listened to what the young man had to say and responded to whatever particular questions the young man was able to ask of him. And the meeting ended, the young man went off, and he was on his way to the front. And a few months later, he was killed. And it was only after his death that Buber learned from a mutual friend that this young man had come to Buber feeling himself to be at a real crossroad in his life, not really knowing how to go forward. And Buber felt that in some way or other, he had missed picking that up. He'd missed picking it up because he was somehow still too involved in the inwardly turned energy that had been part of the meditation that he had just moved from And so he'd been there with the young man, but he hadn't been fully there. He hadn't been there in a way that would have enabled him to really sense what the young man didn't have the words to ask. And he says that this was a real turning point for him. He writes, what do we expect when we are in despair and go to someone? Surely a presence by means of which we are told that nevertheless there is meaning. And he feels he wasn't able to be present, hadn't been able to be present in that kind of a way. And so he says, since then, I have given up the religious, which is nothing but the exception, exaltation, ecstasy. Since then, I possess nothing but the everyday, out of which I am never taken. If that is religion, then it is just everything, all that is lived in its possibility of dialogue. So now, when I hear Buber's eye, I hear the eye of the man who participated in what he thinks of as that failed encounter. I also now hear the voice of the child whose mother had left him without bidding him farewell. The very first little account in meetings, it's a very simple description of his spending a summer. She said to him, how do you feel about the fact that your mother's never coming back? And that was the first he knew. And so whenever I hear Buber say I, part of what I hear is the voice of that child who learned that his mother had left him without even saying goodbye. Among the things that I value in Buber is the way in which, over and over again, he communicates that his speaking is always taking place on the way. That his speaking is always taking place at a particular point along his way. That he's always speaking in relation to a particular other and at a particular historical time. And that also he reveals how some of what he knew because of failures and limitations. In fact, there's a significant sense, I believe, in which this little book, Meetings, should really be called Meetings and Mis-Meetings. There's so many failed meetings. The meetings with the young man who came to consult him, a meeting really that didn't quite happen, right? There's another one that I remember just now of, again, when he'd given a lecture, and afterwards he'd been invited to talk with some of the people who'd been present at the lecture, who were mostly working class people. And one of these older working class men said to Buber, you know, I'm in the world in a real different place from the way you are. I don't need God to feel at home in the world. And Buber started talking to him and trying to tell him about how the world wasn't quite as secure and easy a place as he thought it was. And he kept talking, and of course, you know, he was very articulate and so on. And at the end of this, of Buber's response to the man, the man says, you're right. And then Buber realizes what he's done, that he's won an argument, but that he's not really talked, you know, to this man. I mean, he's due to leave town that night, and there's no way of fixing it, and we've all been there. I mean, in sort of anyway, I think. But I have a sense that there's a way in which Buber learns that all real living is meeting from the many times when the meeting doesn't happen. And especially, I think, from his mother's going. He writes at the end of that account of that experience when he was a four-year-old, "I suspect that all I have learned about genuine meeting during my life had its first origin in that hour on the balcony on my grandfather's estate." And he says that he has come to feel the archetypal aspect of that separation. "I began to perceive it as something that concerned all men, all persons, not just me." This recognition on Buber's part of how the primal separation from the mother, which we all experience, even if not in the dramatic way, obviously, that Buber did, the primal separation from the mother, Buber came to feel, issues in a lifelong longing for connection, a lifelong longing to be fully affirmed, to be fully met. The same recognition, actually, that I believe which Freud came to as the discovery, "I am Oedipus." But this sense of how primal in us is this longing to be met and to be confirmed is really at the heart of Buber's understanding of our human being here. What most moves me in Buber, what I really see as the center of his gift to all of us, is this affirmation of Buber's of the sacredness of those moments when we are really there with another. His sense that it's those moments that life is really for, as though it's those moments in which we most truly experience the presence of the divine. As one of the many who can no longer say do to the dead known God, I so deeply bless Buber's saying, and this is a quote, that everything depends on whether we can still say it to the living unknown God by saying do with all our being to another living and known person. This deep valorization of the betweenness of one human with another stirs me because it's in such deep accord with my own experience. As does also Buber's affirmation that such meetings happen in the most ordinary, the most everyday contexts, not only in the moments of high drama, not only in what he calls the volcanic hours. I value Buber's recognition of this primary word, I you, I thou, ish do, and understand why, to begin with, particularly in his early book, I and Thou, he needed to distinguish what it's like to say I, you, what it's like to turn to another in this kind of way from the other primary word that we spend so much of our time saying, the I, it word, where we turn to even to others as things rather than as other selves. But I value even more Buber's growing recognition of how inevitably intermingled these words are. I also value, and I'm going to talk about this a little bit more later on, Buber's growing clarity as to how different encounter is from mystical fusion, how different communion is from union, how different the everyday is from ecstasy. But first, Remember I spoke earlier of how in my dream it was encountering Buber once again that led me to know it's time now for me to go in search of her. I sense a rightness in this because I sense a deep consonance between what I've learned from Buber and what feminism means to me. I think there's a lot of what I value in Buber that feminists have found along different paths and articulated in different language. Let me try to explain what I mean by this. 40 years ago, in her seminal study, The Second Sex, Simone de Beauvoir helped us to see how women have been the other, have been objects to men, have been encountered as what in Buber's terminology we'd call hits. Buber had shown what it does to be a person, to be the speaker of only one of the two primary words, to be identified with the I of I it, to be someone who doesn't really know how to do this kind of turning to another that he means by ish do. De Beauvoir revealed what it is like to be the object of the primary word. Buber was talking about how it delimits us to be the speaker of just the I, it. What de Beauvoir did was to reveal what it's like to be the object of that primary word. She challenged and encouraged women to become I-sayers, without, however, clearly distinguishing between the I who says I, it, and the I who says I, you. Now, I think this may well have been appropriate, maybe even necessary at the time, because for so long, women's you saying has been one in which the I was lost. You know, we said you in such a big way that we really lost ourselves. We gave ourselves over to relationships. And I do think that there's something about the early and sustained closeness between mothers and daughters, which may make women more likely than men to recreate that almost fused intimacy where there's almost no awareness of the difference between ourselves and others in our later relationships. At the time that he wrote I and Thou, even Buber had At the time he wrote I and Thou, even Buber had trouble clearly distinguishing the primal closeness from this kind of primal closeness, this kind of fusion, from communion, meeting, dialogue. Though he did see how the separation from the primal bond with the mother issues in a yearning, not a yearning for a literal incestual return to her, but rather in a yearning for a you, a yearning to be fully met by another. I think that many of us, and here I'm speaking certainly for myself, I think many of us have had trouble learning how to say you in a way that really respects the otherness of the other and of ourselves. A you saying that's predicated on distance and relation, separation and attachment. A you saying which is also an I saying, but not the I saying of the fully autonomous, wholly independent I of I it. I think there's, you know, we all have, I think, this tendency to turn to another, and what we want is not the otherness, but we want oneness. Buber really understood, as recently feminist psychologists like Nancy Chodorow and Carol Gilligan have, that separation and attachment, I saying and you saying, do not follow one another as sequential stages, but rather occur simultaneously. Both are true. Buber says both. Only an I can say you. And he says, I become I as I say you. Only an I can say you. And I become I as I say you. And I'd add to this, as Buber does later, I become I as you is said to me. In Buber's later writings, he recognizes the centrality of our longing for confirmation. For our longing for confirmation as what we are, as what we are, and at the same time, in some kind of strange way, as what we can become. There's a line at Buber's I like. I secretly and bashfully wish for a yes which allows me to be. Buber also seems to have a really deep appreciation of how difficult it is for us, most of the time anyway, to show ourselves as we really are. Among the most powerful passages for me when I first read Between Man and Man was the one in which Buber speaks of how readily we can fall into what he calls seeming. How readily substitute the pretense of dialogue for an actual reaching out to the other. And I felt that this was something he knew because he'd learned it in his own life. I still remember how powerfully this passage struck me when I read it as a young woman, when I read it in my 20s. How I felt seen in both a judging and a challenging kind of way. Forced to recognize how much I fled from risking true encounter. Though really being seen was what I most deeply coveted. Buber writes, to yield to seeming is man's essential cowardice. To resist it is essential courage. And in the same paragraph where he has that sentence, he also talks about how, no matter how often we've yielded to seeming, it's still always possible to resist it. He has such a sense, I think, of how deeply we long for real connection and how early we are wounded in our capacity for it. And so because of that, we hide behind seeming. We hide behind a persona. Out of our deep longing to be found lovable, we present ourselves in a way that we think will look lovable, right? But, of course, the love that we get for the mask, for the persona, for the presentation, doesn't assuage the yearning that we have to be loved for who we are. Right? Well, you all see. And of course also he has such a recognition of the way in which we're also kind of afraid of the change in us that's likely to ensue if real meeting actually occurs. There's a phrase of Buber's I love. In fact, I once thought I was going to write a book with this title, but it's one of those many books I began and didn't finish. It's called Imagining the Real. And he uses this phrase as a way of pointing to what really making the other present as other entails. He speaks of what's involved here. Well, one of the things he does is he reiterates the distinction between empathy and sympathy, which I think is a really important distinction. You know, the distinction between having a sense of what you're feeling as something that you are feeling. And I have some sense of what it is you're feeling because I've been there or been to somewhere sort of like that. But what I'm really aware of is that what's happening right now is that you are having a feeling. And that my way of responding to that is to respond to your having that feeling and not to start having that feeling myself. So he speaks of what he says that what's involved here is a bold swinging into the other's life. At the same time remembering that other's otherness and ultimate mysteriousness. But part of what's involved here in this real contact with another as another is honoring, and I would say even celebrating, the forever unknowability of the other. You know, the mysteriousness, the not-me-ness, the not-encompassable by me aspect of that other. And that this demands, he says, the most intensive stirring of one's own being to really allow another to be a self and to really have a sense of a meeting between myself and yourself. And also that part of what's involved in this is turning towards the other in a way that sees that other both as where that particular you is and where that person is in his potentiality moving toward. I'm not sure I have exactly the right language for this, but he says, I have it here, recognizing in him or her the person they were created to become. Though, you know, Buber's smart, he also recognizes how often we're mistaken, you know, when we do this. And yet there's something about really fully seeing another that you see the in-motion part of them and not just the part that's already here. He also has such a real sense that for the kind of engagement, the kind of meeting, the kind of encounter that he's talking about, that this entails full mutuality. This full turning of one to the other is something that has to be happening from both sides. And because of that, from Buber's perspective, a full IU kind of meeting is not really possible. And this is something we may talk about tomorrow during the workshop, and we may have some disagreements about this, because tomorrow we're going to talk some about how this might relate to psychotherapy. But from Buber's perspective, this full kind of meeting, this full kind of IU, I-thou kind of meeting is not possible between parent and child, teacher and student, or therapist and patient. That's not what's going on in that relationship. It's not the role of the child or the student or the patient to be fully turned towards the parent or the teacher or the therapist. That's not what that relationship is about. There's a wonderful discussion between Buber and Carl Rogers, where Carl Rogers keeps saying, "I'm more a Buberian than you are," because they're disagreeing about this particular thing. So Buber is saying that for each, the other happens as a particular other, as a partner in a living event. And let me read a little quote. "This person is other, essentially other than myself. And this otherness of hers is what I mean. Because I mean her, I confirm it. I wish her otherness to exist. That she does not have merely a different mind or way of thinking or feeling or a different conviction or attitude, but has also a different perception of the world, a different recognition and order of meaning, a different touch from the regions of existence, a different faith, a different soil, to affirm all this, to affirm it in the way of a creature, in the midst of the hard situations of conflict, without relaxing their real seriousness. This is what I mean by I and you. Now, I've suggested several times that Buber only gradually came to recognize the difference between union and communion, fusion and encounter. And it was really a profound immersion in the Hebrew Bible that began in midlife that clarified this for him. As a brilliant young man, Buber had found himself pulled in many directions, you know, just pulled in so many different ways. And at that point, pretty much at the beginning of our century, he turned to a study of Jewish mysticism, of Hasidism, as a way of grounding himself, feeling that perhaps his way to self-discovery might lead through his self-discovery of himself as a Jew. And by 1910, he had published several books in which he retold the Hasidic tales. And this had made him a very highly well-recognized, prominent young Jewish thinker, which was why that young man came to see him at the beginning of the First World War. And Buber himself says that it was out of that meeting that didn't happen with the young man, that I-Thou meeting that didn't happen, that the book I and Thou emerged. And then, on the other side of having written that book, Franz Rosenzweig came to Buber and said, you know, Buber, what you and I ought to do is to translate the Hebrew Bible into German. Buber said, why? There's a wonderful, beautiful German translation of the Hebrew Bible that Martin Luther did, that actually created the modern German language. And Rosenzweig said, yes, I know, but Luther's Bible is through and through colored with Christian presuppositions. We need to translate the Hebrew Bible, into German. And they got involved in doing that. And I'm taking more time than I should have, so I'm going to skip a little bit over some of this. But it was during this immersion in the Hebrew Bible was really something that led Buber really for the first time to get deeply involved with the Hebrew Bible. And it was out of this deep immersion in the Hebrew Bible that he came to see that it is the you that is spoken to, came to see the you that is spoken to me as more central than the you that I speak. And he focuses there on the way in which in the Hebrew Bible, over and over again, God appears and says, you. He says, you to Adam. He says, you to Abraham. He says, you to Moses. He comes to the prophets and says, you to them. And over again, these persons who were addressed by God's you were not seekers. They have a you that comes from God that they try to back away from. They say, go find someone else and so on. But eventually, this you that's spoken to them is what ends up shaping their lives, what ends up giving them their identity, their role, and all of that. So I'm going to skip a lot of things that I have here. Yes? Yeah, I do. I mean, I just want to finish one more thing and then we'll have a break and we'll have discussion afterwards. There are things I was going to do, but it doesn't matter. You know, I want to end in the way that I wanted to end, okay, with my talk. And so, at the end of his life, after he, you know, has translated the Hebrew Bible and written a lot of commentaries on the Hebrew Bible, and Buber returns to the Hasidic tales, which he had translated as a very young man and decides that he needs to retranslate them in a way that's congruent with the deeper understanding that he has come to at the end of his life. And he continues to have a sense that these stories have the power to communicate a perspective that can be enormously illuminating for all of us. And I just want to end here by just quickly telling two of those stories. One is the story of the cloak. It's a story about a woman who had been in most ways, happily married for a very long while. She wasn't exactly happy, though, because she'd never been able to have a child. And she was coming, she was really approaching menopause and was afraid that she was never going to have the child that she and her husband had deeply longed for in all the many years of their marriage. And then she heard that one of the great Hasidic teachers, the Maggid of Mezrich, was coming to her town. And so she made her way to the inn where he was staying, and she told him about how deeply she and her husband still longed to have a child. And he looked at her, and he said, "I can really understand that." And he said, "One of the reasons I can really understand that is that many years ago, my mother found herself in exactly..."